I'm super excited to introduce our guest speaker this morning, Carl Medeiros. Would you, wait, before he comes and before we welcome him, he's got some books at the back, Speaking of Jesus. How many of you have read this? Okay, everyone else, you're wrong. That's probably too strong. This is called Speaking of Jesus, The Art of Non-Evangelism. We've got several of them in the back. An incredible book, really has changed the way I think about sharing my faith and engaging in conversations with people. And so just remind you about that, the connections table after the service. Let's welcome Carl Medeiros. Put our hands together.
Good morning. It's nice to be here again. Matt and I were talking about what I could or should share this morning and kind of agreed that I would talk about, you know, themes from that book, things about sharing our faith, sharing Jesus. And then last night I said, actually, I think I changed my mind. Can I talk about something different? And then what's he supposed to say? He's like, okay, you know, because I was saying I've changed my mind, but I was pretending to kind of ask him, but I was really just saying, I don't want to talk about that. So, I mean, I always want to talk about sharing Jesus because, I mean, that's just so interesting. It's so much fun to talk to our friends and neighbors and family about him. But I want to kind of focus on a specific thing that I think a lot of us deal with, and it's the idea of giving up, or in this case, actually not giving up. I think sometimes when life gets hard, life throws you curveballs, and life does that. Sometimes life is difficult. You have difficult situations. All of us do. It's tempting to give up. So that's what I want to talk about. So I'm going to tell three really bad stories first, maybe four. I've written down like 85, like things I've done that are really stupid that didn't work and whatever. But I actually mostly wrote a whole book about that. It's called Adventures in Saying Yes. It's the last book out. I don't think we have any here, but it's a book basically about failures. And if I were honest, all the things I've tried, things that I think God has told me to do, that I tried to do, thinking God wanted me to do them, and I did them the best I could that didn't work, it's at least 100-1 on the didn't work side. But then mostly the one story gets preached and, you know, gets in the book. So that's kind of how we, and hopefully, I think that's part of God's self, kind of our coping mechanism, right, to deal with life. Because if we really focused on our failures all the time, we would feel like we are failures, and then that doesn't work very well. So I want to talk about what it takes to not give up, what it takes to keep going. So I'm going to tell a couple of stories here. They're just kind of, they're kind of funny, and they get funnier the further I am removed from them. You know what I mean? Because at the time, they weren't funny at all. For instance, so when I was 20 years old, I spent a year with a group called YWAM, Youth with a Mission. And it's a group that sends people out around the world irresponsibly to die and do horrible things that don't really work. So I spent a year with them. And on my training part, I ended up going to Yemen. And I was in Holland doing something called the Discipleship Training School for 6 months, where you learn to be like Jesus. And I was 20 years old and still, I mean, I thought I knew a lot. You know, it's funny, you know way more when you're younger than when you get older. So at 20, I was fairly precocious. I mean, I'm still precocious, but I was really precocious and very cocky when I was 20. And you're probably like, I can imagine that. And so they had a volunteer thing, who wanted to go where for their 3-month outreach, and everybody signed up for Africa and all over, you know, Japan, and then there in Europe, and there was a place for Yemen, which is a country in the Middle East you may have heard of, and this is 1983, and I wanted to go to Yemen. And they're like, well, but nobody else is going there. I go, that's okay, but I mean, that's where I want to go. So again, being YWAM, they sent me off by myself to Yemen, and which is really crazy. You know, I mean, I don't know what they were thinking. Anyway, you had a transit through Saudi Arabia. So I flew to Jordan from Holland, from Amsterdam to Jordan. And then I had a transit flight from going south. I'm actually doing the map here in my head, Jordan down to Yemen. But you have to go through Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, which is right in the Red Sea, just for like a 3-hour transfer. So I got to Jeddah. Two guards met me at the airplane and escorted me to jail. And I said something like, what are you doing? And they said, well, you can't go through Jeddah. You don't have a transit visa. I said, well, I'm just changing planes and going to Yemen. They go, yeah, you can't do that. You have to go to jail. I'm like, what? Are you? I thought they were like joking or something, but they didn't look like they were joking. So they put me in the airport jail and with about 100 Bangladeshi refugees in a room, maybe 30 foot by 30 foot. So we're like literally packed in there. And then I'm telling the guard, like, I'm going to miss my flight. And anyway, 2 days later, I'd missed that flight and several flights. I'm 20 years old. I don't speak any Arabic or Bengali or really anything besides a little English. And then I'm just stuck in the jail. I missed my flight and the next flight and the next flight and the next flight. Somebody was supposed to pick me up in Yemen, some guy named Bruce, who I don't know, some guy from Australia, believe it or not, named Bruce. I know it's shocking. So I don't know what Bruce is thinking. I've never met Bruce before. And then 3 days later, they just decided to let me go. So after 3 days, I had no food, a little bit of dirty water that we all shared, and I was sick. I had diarrhea, anyway, let's not talk about that. It was pretty miserable, and I was kind of in and out of being sad and angry and kind of mad at God and mad at YWAM, obviously, and mad at Saudi Arabia, and there was really nothing redemptive about that story, or I was just sick and mad. And then they finally let me go. I went to Yemen, but I was 3 days late. So I got to the airport in Yemen. Of course, nobody's there. I don't know where Bruce is. I don't know what Bruce looks like, by the way. And there was nobody that looked like a Bruce. So then I waited in the Yemen airport for 2 days. I'm just 20. I've never, this is my first trip on an airplane in my life. Was when I flew from Denver, where I grew up, when I was 20 years old. I'd never been on an airplane before. And I flew to Amsterdam, which is kind of scary. And then I was in YWAM. Then my next flight was to Yemen. And so it's not going very well. And then finally, after 2 days in Yemen, a guy came up to me. He was white. And I thought, he started walking up to me. And I said, Bruce? And it was Bruce. And he's like, Carl? And we hugged. And I cried for a long time. And that was it. So that's one story. And really, again, there's nothing really good happened out of that. I was really sick and really mad and was mad at God and confused and thinking, I'm trying to serve you, God. I mean, well, hello. We're on a team here, you know, together. You're not doing your part very well. But I just remember thinking as I was in the Saudi jail for 3 days, I mean, I'd have little burst of godly moments where I'd pray for Saudi Arabia because I'm a missionary. I thought I should actually pray for Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia sounds kind of big and scary, and it's the home of Mecca and Islam and all that stuff. So I'd pray, but then mostly just got mad. And so that was it. So and I came back to Colorado Springs, met my wife, Chris. We got married, and we started going to a church, and I became an intern pastor. And we know what intern pastor means. You work all the time for no pay. So I was doing that, and I was in charge of the homeless ministry. So we'd do pancake breakfast, and we'd do all kinds of stuff with the homeless in Colorado Springs that was not very effective, and nobody really cared, and it didn't go very well. and then somebody had an idea we should make sandwiches for the Job Corps, you know, guys that come in for day labor, and take them sandwiches. And we put like a little card in there, you know, this is from our church, and we love you, and so does God, or something corny like that. And so we did that, and it was a whole team of people. So we'd make the sandwiches on Monday night, and then the team would deliver it on Tuesday morning, which was me and a couple guys. And then it was me and my wife making sandwiches on Monday night, and then me delivering it on Tuesday morning. And you know how teams go in church work. And so the team was ended up, then my wife got tired, so then it was me making sandwiches on Monday night and me delivering them on Tuesday morning. And I did that for 5 years every Tuesday morning, and nobody got saved, or I don't think they even liked the lunch. I don't think anybody ever came to church from that ministry that I did for 5 years. But I did it every Tuesday morning. And then I remember I was a small group leader, like one of these small groups. By the way, small groups are the Jeremy, you owe me, wherever you are, by the way. But small groups are the best thing of church. I mean, really, this is fun, but I actually honestly think the best thing of church, the best thing of life of church is being involved in small groups. So I've always believed in that. So I sort of started a small group. I kind of inherited it because the small group leader that I was going to quit, not that this will happen to you in your small groups, but it did me. Like the second time I was at my small group, the guy quit, and then the pastor said, do you want to lead a small group? I said, no. And then I did. And then this prison ministry lady, this like 85-year-old lady named Sheila, who is in the maximum security prison down in Canyon City, south of Colorado Springs, came to my small group one night. She was visiting our church and just happened to end up at mine. And she said, would you like to go and come down to prisons and help me? I said, no, that sounds horrible. There are prisoners in there. They're scary. And so then I did. And then we started on one Wednesday night. And the second Wednesday night, she said, would you like to speak? I said, I've never preached in my life. No, I don't want to speak. And these guys look really scary. It's a maximum security prison. They were all like three times my size. And I said, I definitely don't want to do that. And then I did. And then it wasn't good at all. It was the worst sermon. There was a guy, I'm not making this up. The guy sat in the front row who the whole time, he went like this, and his arms were bigger than my legs. And every once in a while, he would just stare at me. Every once in a while, he'd go like this. And I don't even think he was saying, you're speaking too long, stop. I think he was saying, I'm going to kill you. You know, he was just glaring at me. And I just remember, I was just terrified. So I went to this prison every year for 7 years, actually. Every Wednesday night. Every Wednesday night, literally. Every Wednesday night, including over Christmas break, for 7 years. And lots of people got saved in prison. By the way, lots of people would pray and receive Christ. And I'm not saying that wasn't good. It's just that you do kind of have a captive audience. And so you tell them stuff about Jesus and freedom, and they get excited about that. And I think they often misinterpret what you're actually saying. But nobody ever became a tithing member of our church from that audience, you know. And so mostly, I just think mostly my life, my early life of seriously following Jesus, literally, like seriously, I'm all in, I'm going to follow Jesus with everything I have, was not just full of insignificance or even failure, but just kind of me wandering around doing stuff and thinking, I wonder if anybody cares, or I wonder if, is this helping anybody, or, I mean, nobody's coming to our church from any of this stuff that I'm doing. I mean, I was mostly focused on the homeless population and prisoners, and so they just wouldn't come to our church. And that was pretty much it. I mean, I did a lot of stuff like that. But, you know, the interesting thing is, I don't know why this was in me, but I just always had this feeling that I shouldn't give up. I mean, I would say more than anything else in my life, in my early days, following Jesus seriously, I had this thing in me that I shouldn't stop, that I should just keep going, and that the results, I know this sounds kind of cliche-ish, but the results weren't up to me, and I just knew that. I knew that was true. Maybe it was for my parents. I mean, my dad was a pastor, and my dad pastored lots of little churches around the Midwest. I think the biggest church he ever started, he took over a church of 30 people once in western Nebraska. And then he grew it to be a mega church of about 150 because the town was only like 2,000 people. So, I mean, we had like 10% of the whole town in our church. I thought that was kind of cool. But I think I learned that from my dad, my mom. I just remember every morning, whatever time I'd get up in the morning, my mom would already be up praying. My dad would already be up reading the Bible. I have these memories in my head of my parents not being perfect. They worked too hard, that ministry was everything to them, they ignored me too much. I mean, all these kinds of things, you know, but they didn't give up. So I kind of had that in my DNA. But I think, honestly, if you looked at my life when I was 30 years old, Chris and I, my wife and I, moved to Beirut, Lebanon when I was 30. That's also funny. I mean, we announced to our church, I mean, a long process, that we're going to be missionaries to the Middle East. And the church was behind it and stuff. And we announced that I was going to plant, my last Sunday preaching at our church, we were going to start 7 churches in 7 cities. Start in Beirut and then go to Damascus, Syria, then Baghdad, and then Amman, Jordan, and then Cairo, Egypt, then Jerusalem, then Nicosia, Cyprus, and 1 church each year. And everybody's like, that's a great idea. You should laugh at that. You should say, that's ridiculous, Carl. You can't plant 7. Do you speak Arabic? Nobody said to me, Carl, do you speak Arabic? Because, you know, those places speak Arabic. You might need to know Arabic. Nobody even asked me that question. They're like, that's awesome. Go get them. So we fly off to Beirut. And then, of course, 12 years later in Beirut, you know, we're still planting the first church. But nobody ever mentioned that. Nobody's like, Carl, do you remember that when you said, you know, so they're, you know, gracious, which is nice. But I mean, think about how ridiculous that was. And we went off with 2 little baby girls thinking that we're going to conquer the world. Our girls were 18 months old and 3 months old. Anna Medeiros was our oldest daughter. She since came back and went to Taylor University and came to this church, by the way, which is kind of fun. And she's now back in Beirut. She almost, I would say at least once a week, she'll text me or email us or call Mom and I. And we'll have a Skype call or a FaceTime call. And she'll say, Mom, I just met somebody who came to your Olive Grove, that's what we call our church, whose life has been changed. She meets people like that all the time. We didn't see that. Frankly, we didn't see that when we were there. We just saw ourselves stumbling along, making lots of mistakes, screwing up all the time, you know, trying to speak Arabic. We told, the first conversation I had, seriously in Arabic, I told the neighbor lady that her house was ugly. I thought the word ugly was beautiful. And she went like that, and I go, yeah, I know, it's really ugly. You know, I said it again. Because that's what you do. When you don't speak language, you keep saying it, and then you raise your voice. And so I kept telling her house is ugly. And then we couldn't figure out, why won't she talk? Like 3 months, she wouldn't talk to us. And we thought, that's the weirdest thing. We tell her house is beautiful, and then she doesn't talk to us. But anyway, so we did lots of those things. But now our daughter's back there, and she's running a business incubator and making films and just having this huge impact on the nation. Our 25-year-old little daughter, Anna, who used to live in Upland and who grew up in Beirut, who's now back in Beirut. So here's the transition. The transition is this verse, and this is the only verse I'm going to share. I do get critiqued sometimes for not opening the Bible enough, you know. So let's act like we're opening the Bible. I actually know this verse. It's just one verse, so I actually know it by heart, I think. And you may have known it as well. It's Galatians 6:9, if you want to read it later. It just says, do not grow weary in doing good. I think Paul probably says that because he knows that we do grow weary in doing good. Don't you sometimes, you just kind of go, why do I always have to be the mature one in this relationship? Like, why can't they be mature? I'm tired of always being the one that sucks it up. I'm tired of, you know, if you're married, it could be that, or if you have a friend, or if you have, well, any kind of a life, then sometimes you might get tired of being the good one. Now, maybe you're the bad one and that doesn't connect with you, but I always kind of feel like, why do I have to be the good one? I mean, I want to throw a temper tantrum. I want to be a baby. I want to yell at you. I want to tell you that I'm leaving this church because I don't like the color of the carpet. I want to be the guy that leaves something. Why am I always the guy that stays? I don't like that. So Paul says, don't grow weary in doing good, for this is a great clause, for at the proper time, or in due time, I think King James says in due time, at the proper time, I call that the God clause, so you don't know what the proper time is, but don't grow weary in doing good, for at the proper time, if you do not give up, you will reap a harvest. Isn't that a power-packed verse? That's just one verse, Galatians 6:9. Don't grow weary in doing good, for at the proper time, if you don't give up, you will reap a harvest. There's a promise. Hear the promise at the end. You will reap a harvest. Now, I think that could be a harvest in your life personally, like you'll bear fruit if you don't give up. And it's a harvest around you. There are people around you that need to know Jesus, how wonderful, how good he is, what an amazing king he is of this incredible kingdom that he rules over that we're hopefully part of. And if you're not part of, you can just say yes to Jesus and you become part of it. And so we want to talk about this. So you can bear fruit in people around you. But there's only one conditional point. If you don't give up. Isn't that interesting? There's no place in the Bible, I think this is true, I say this a lot, so I hope it's actually true, I think this is true, there's no place in the Bible that says we should pray for the harvest to be ripe. There's two conditions, one in John chapter 4, that you need to have laborers that go out and pick the fruit. I mean, so if you're in an orchard with pears, you're in a pear orchard with pear trees, and you walk around, you don't need to walk around the trees 7 times and pray that the pear tree will have pears. Pear trees have pears, and then when they're fruit, when they're ripe, you know, because you squeeze them when they're a little bit soft and you pick them kind of gently. They come off the, you know, the branch pretty easily. And then you bite into it. It's sweet. It's yummy. It's ripe. You don't have to pray about it being ripe. There's no place that says pray for their harvest to be ripe. I think it's okay to pray for people that know Jesus, but I think it's kind of unnecessary. I know that sounds shocking. Actually, what's necessary is that you go talk to people about Jesus. And what's necessary is that you don't give up. Two conditions only on bearing fruit in your life and around us. Do it. Be a laborer. Be a fruit picker. And don't give up. So fast forward to this year, 2017. So now Chris and I live in Dubai. Anna lives in Beirut. Our other two kids live here in the States. We live in Dubai from October to May. We prayed really hard, and we feel like God didn't want us to be in Dubai in the summertime. He said, go to Colorado in the summertime. So being the obedient and humble servants that we are, we live in the Colorado Mountains from May to October and Dubai October to May. It's totally cheating, the whole system of God's weather, isn't it? But we like it. And so we live in Dubai now. So in the last year, I went to Saudi Arabia in March. And when I landed in Saudi Arabia in Jeddah this time, same city as 1983. Remember my first Saudi Arabia story. Now I've been to Saudi Arabia many times between now and then. But I landed in Jeddah back in March. Literally was picked up on the tarmac in a limousine by the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia's personal driver, driven through the VIP section, and they took my passport and did all the passport stuff with me. I came in and I spent those next 3 days in Jeddah and then Riyadh with the coming to be, soon to be, King of Saudi Arabia. And we talked for pretty much 3 days about, what would you guess? Starts with a J. Have you heard me speak before? Rhymes with Bezos. We talked about Jesus. Isn't that interesting? So I haven't thought about 83 to 2017. I don't know. How many years is that? 34 years? I'm a history major. I mean, I don't really do math. So a long time later, here I am hosted by the royal family of Saudi Arabia. Also in March, in fact, the day after I got back from this trip, I have a friend, his name is Ali, who is a former prime minister of Somalia. He and his wife, Miriam, came to visit us in Dubai for 5 days. He was the prime minister of Somalia actually during the infamous Black Hawk Down time, so not a very good time. Somalia, you may have heard of Somalia. It's not like doing very well. You know, there's pirates. You've seen Captain Phillips, maybe the movie. There's Al-Shabaab, the bad guys that are, you know, kind of the ISIS version in Somalia are called Al-Shabaab. They're causing chaos. There's a horrible drought and famine there now. In fact, the UN says the famine in Somalia, northern Kenya, southeastern Ethiopia is the worst famine and drought. I mean, the famine comes from the drought, no rain, in 50 years anywhere in the world. And people are dying and starving to death, and malaria and cholera is rampant. So anyway, Ali has moved now back to Somalia and has carved out a new state right in the center of Somalia, just north of Mogadishu. And he's trying to make a functional state. And so he's appointed himself president. He has a cabinet. He has a whole government in this state. And nobody cares too much because nobody, even in Somalia, cares about this part of Somalia. It's very desolate. You really can't get there. There's almost no way to get there. Anyway, he and his wife came to Dubai to visit Chris and I. Spent 5 days together. And we're having lunch one day. And he looked across the table at me and he said, Carl, would you ever consider visiting Somalia? He said, I just want you to know it's really dangerous, but would you ever visit? I said, of course. And he goes, really? I said, Ali, you know me. I've known him for 15 years. I said, of course I'd visit. And then Chris, my wife, she's like, of course he'd visit. This is like his dream, to go to a place where he could get killed. And so, interestingly, she's always happy for me to go there. So I don't know. I don't know exactly what that says, but she's like, yeah, you should go. And so I said, Ali, how many people have visited you in Somalia? He said, nobody. I said, no, like in all the 2 years that you've set up this new state, how many people have visited you there? Like from anywhere, like from Kenya, other parts of Somalia, anywhere. He said, zero, nobody. I said, nobody? He goes, yes, it's very dangerous. He's like, so you'll come? And I said, sure. And I said, but I don't travel alone, so I need to get a couple friends who are crazy enough to come. And so I asked some friends, and believe it or not, six of my friends, five Americans and one Aussie, came, not the same Aussie Bruce, not that guy. He's long since, I don't know where he is, but I don't even like him. No, I'm joking. He'll probably listen to this tape. Sorry, Bruce, I love you, wherever you are. He stopped talking to me. So another Aussie guy who lives in northern Spain, he's a professional surfer, actually. Again, to keep the stereotype going, but his name's not Bruce. And five Americans, they all said to come. They'd come. So we set a date. We flew to Addis Ababa, which is the capital of Ethiopia, which is kind of close to Somalia, if you know your geography. And then an airplane, a small twin-engine King Air 350 11-seater was going to fly us from Addis into this. That's the only way you can get there. I mean, you can't take a bus. There's no trains. There's no cars. You can't rent a taxi. There's no Uber in Somalia. And so, and there's no commercial flights. So you have to pay, well, a lot of money, actually, to get this guy, who's an Ethiopian pilot, to fly us on his little airplane, And so he came to meet us the night before. We're going to leave the next morning. There's me and my six friends. And they said, you know, we just got a phone call from the neighboring part of Somalia, the neighboring state. It's called Puntland. And that president said he heard that seven Americans are coming to visit his rival, Ali, who's my friend, who started the new state in Somalia. And if you come in tomorrow morning, we know you're coming in at 10, we're going to shoot your plane down. So this is April 10th of this year. So my cousin's with me on the trip, and my cousin's an ex-Special Forces guy. He was in charge of a unit, if you know that language. And so kind of a big deal. So I brought him along, because he loves Jesus, and he's an ex-Special Forces guy. Not that I'm not relying on God to protect me, but I just thought, you know, he wanted to go. And he actually really did want to go. And he had spent some time in Somalia before professionally, let's say. So I was like, this is interesting. So as soon as the guy comes and says they're going to shoot the plane down, I looked at my cousin Jeremy, and he's like, we're out. We're out. We can't go. And I go, what? Well, you're the... No, we're still going. And he's like, no, we can't go. And then everybody's listening to him, not to me, because they think I'm crazy. So they think he's responsible, which would seem probably right. And so everybody's like, okay, we're out. We can't go. And I looked at the captain. I said, no, we still want to go. I want to go. He goes, well, you know what? I'm not flying there because I don't want my plane to get shot down, and you can't get there anywhere else, so you're not going. And so here, all of a sudden, I thought, we've just flown from all around the world to Addis in Ethiopia to fight a Somali tomorrow morning. I'd felt really clearly that God had orchestrated this. My wife and I agreed that we should go, that I should go. Everybody had prayed about it. I told all of them, they knew we were going to Somalia, and they all prayed, they all talked to their spouses, they all did whatever, and they decided that God wanted them, and here we are, and now there's this little detail of getting shot down, and they're out. So I said to the airline pilot, I said, is there no way to, he's like, no. I can't take you in if they're going to shoot us down, obviously. And I don't know why you'd want to go, but, you know, that's your issue, but I'm not going. And then I had a thought, because I've learned to not give up easily. And so I just said, what if we call the president of Puntland? And he goes, well, how are we going to call him? I said, don't you know anybody that knows somebody that knows him? And he goes, oh, actually, my friend Hersey's wife is good friends with the president's wife. I go, well, get him over here. So he calls this guy, and about an hour later, he comes to our hotel. We're just sitting there kind of praying and kind of worrying, praying. And this guy comes, and I said, does your wife know the president's wife? He's like, oh, yeah. I said, well, quick, call your wife and tell her to call his wife, and then have the president call. I said, can he call your phone, the captain of the little airplane? He goes, sure. Like five minutes later, the captain, Ethiopian guy with the little airplane's phone rang, and he went like this, hello? And he goes, oh, just a minute. And then he just hands the phone to me. He goes, it's the president. I'm like, hello? He goes, yes, this is president. I actually don't remember his name. I go, hi, this is Carl. He goes, yes, are you the one trying to go to the illegal state to visit the pretend president? He's speaking in English. By the way, this guy grew up in Minneapolis. Who knew? So he spoke like Minnesotan. And he said, I said, yes, we are. He said, you can't do that or I'm going to shoot your plane down. He said, just like that. Like, I thought, well, at least he's clear. I mean, he's consistent, you know, with this shoot the plane down thing. And I said, you know, I'm so sorry. I'm an American. I don't really understand the politics of Somalia. I obviously got between you and Ali, and I don't even know what that means to be between you. I don't even know where, you know. I said, I shouldn't have said this, but I go, I don't even know where Puntland is, which he's the president. That was stupid. But anyway, that came out of my mouth because I didn't know where it was. And then I said, you know, and then I just had this thought right there on the phone because everybody on my team was like, what are you going to say to him? I said, well, I don't know. I'll figure that out when he calls. You know, and by the way, there's a little verse in Acts that I kind of like that says, you know, when you stand before kings, God will give you the words to say. And I actually believe that's true because I actually believe the Bible's true and it says that. And it says other things also like don't fear. And I think it's actually pretty serious about that. So I try to do what it says and not be afraid. And so it came to my mind to say to him, what if we come to you tomorrow morning first and we'll have breakfast with you? I invited myself over to his place for breakfast. And we'll have breakfast with you. And then if you like us, you can let us go, and if you don't like us, then we'll go back to Addis. And he said, really? You would do that? And then I put my hand on the phone. I said, Captain, is it possible to fly to Puntland? I mean, I don't know what that is, but he goes, sure, it will cost you $3,000 extra. And I looked at everybody, and they're like, they don't even know what's going on. So I go, okay, yes, we can come. I mean, is it, would 10 o'clock be fine? He's like, sure. So we did. We flew the next morning to Puntland, landed on a dirt airstrip, and there were like 100 guys with machine guns there to welcome us. And we had breakfast, and about 5 minutes in, he goes, who's the friend of Ali? Who is Mr. Carl? And of course, everybody points at me, like that guy right there. And I go, that's me. And he's like, why do you love him? Why do you want to go to this part of the... And I said, well, you know, this might sound crazy, but we're all followers of Jesus, and we feel like we want to follow Jesus there. He goes, wait, what? I said, we want to follow Jesus to Khatumu, this area of Somalia, because we think Jesus is there, and we want to go, you know, visit him. I say things like that as if it makes sense. Like, you know, obviously. And he goes, that's the strangest thing I've ever heard. And then this is 5 minutes into it. And then he goes, but, you know, I like that you're honest. You can go ahead and go. And then he comes over to me right after that. He goes, by the way, I'm a believer too. And I said, I go, what? I should have said something more profound, but usually I say, most of my life is like really saying, what? And so I said, what? And he goes, we'll talk later. And then we didn't even have breakfast. And then he just told us to go. And then we flew off. We were there for like 20 minutes. And we flew to Khatumu. We landed there, got greeted also by another 100 guys with machine guns. And there was this guy with a minivan that had a turret out of the top of the, you know, the sunroof of his minivan that I thought, that's not a very cool look, really. A minivan machine gun thing, you know. But anyway, so then we went out to the one well. There was one well for about 150,000 people. And there were about 1,000 people around this well. And they actually said, you know, by the way, it hasn't rained here for 13 months, and people come to this well to die. And we didn't see any dead people, but people had died that day. There were carcasses of animals there. There were herds of camels. It was unbelievable. At least 1,000 Somalis. They'd heard their president, Ali, was coming, and they'd probably heard there were some Americans as well. So there was this huge crowd. And they gathered around us, and people were shouting at Ali, probably about, you know, why can't you bring water, and what are these Americans doing here? And then Ali shouts in this loud voice in Somali. I speak Arabic, but not Somali, so I don't know what he's saying. And after he speaks, everybody claps and looks at me. And I'm thinking, I don't know what that is, but that's maybe they're just happy we're here, or I don't know. And he goes, I just told them that you're a sheikh. You know, sheikh is like, you know, Matt's a pastor, a Muslim sheikh is like imam. I told him that Sheikh Carl was going to pray now for rain. And I said, what? See, that I do say that a lot. Things like that happen. I go, oh, no. And I go, no. When was the last time? And I looked up and there's no clouds. And I think, no. I mean, even with Elijah, there was like a little tiny cloud. Then he prayed for rain and it became a bigger cloud. There's no clouds. And I'm not Elijah. And I've never done a rain prayer. I don't know a rain dance. And I don't have any faith. I'm thinking, I don't want to pray for rain. And then everybody's looking at me like, okay, you know, let's go, Sheikh Carl. And I actually was mad at him. I thought, you can't just like volunteer me to pray for someone that I don't even know if I should pray for or believe in. And then, you know what he does? This is my Muslim friend, Ali. His wife is a believer, by the way, and he's really close to the kingdom. Remember, the former prime minister. He hugs me and he goes, don't worry, Carl, I believe. I was like, oh man, the Muslim guy has more faith than I do. This is all mixed up. And so I prayed, and I prayed like one of the top 10 wimpiest prayers ever. You know how you pray a wimpy prayer for a miracle is you put, if it be your will, and there are a lot. Because then if it doesn't happen, you go, well, I guess God didn't want that to happen. So it's the God miracle out clause. Like, you know, this probably won't work anyway. So I said, you know, God, if it rains, I mean, if you let it rain, that'd be really nice. Mostly I'm thinking because I'm going to be really embarrassed if it doesn't. So it was like a totally horrible, selfish prayer, no faith. I mean, honestly, I thought there's no way. It had not rained a drop in 13 months. But I prayed. I mean, I did muster up enough whatever to pray loudly in English, and Ali interpreted the prayer. He finished interpreting. Everybody clapped, and everybody's like, inshallah, which means God willing. You know, they're all like, inshallah. And I'm thinking, oh, yeah. Come on, God, you can do it. And we left, and then it poured rain that night. It just like dumped rain. I mean, it rained and rained and rained. It actually rained the rest of the time we were there. And then people were coming to the little hotel. I call it a hotel, but it was like, it was really bad. But anyway, they kept coming there asking me and us to pray for their cousin and pray for healing and pray for this and pray for that. And this little really cool thing happened between Ali and the rivaling state. And the last night we were there, my surfer friend Jonathan, he said, you know, I said, let's all talk about what we think we can offer, you know, what we can do. He goes, you know, dude. And then there's like this long pause, like he's had way too much sun or other things in his life. He's like, you know, dude. Okay, I'll stop talking like him because I only have like 2 minutes left. This will take a long time. He goes, one of the biggest wave breaks in the whole world, every big wave surfer knows it, is somewhere off the coast of Somalia, but nobody ever goes there because, you know, it's Somalia. And so he gets his phone, believe it or not, there's nothing in Somalia, but there's Wi-Fi. And so he Googles big waves in Somalia. Turns out the biggest wave breaks are off the coast of Puntland, which is the neighboring state with the president that wanted to shoot us down, who's now my friend. And so I said, I have President, you know, Bob or whatever his name is, phone. Probably not Bob. Probably Muhammad, President Muhammad's phone. So I called him on his cell phone. I said, Mr. Carl. He had put my phone in his phone. And he goes, yeah, how are you doing? I said, we're doing great over here with your friend Ali. And he goes, rah, rah. He goes, that guy's not my friend. I go, okay, well, he could be your friend. But anyway, so is it true that you have big waves off the coast of Portland? He goes, oh, yes, in Pirate's Cove. It's actually called Pirate's Cove. I go, perfect. And but there are big waves there? Yeah, there are. And I go, we like to, so anyway, long story, we've started Surf Somalia, and surfsomalia.com is our domain, and Jeremy, my chicken cousin, who is Delta guy, just went there and just got back 2 days ago and did a 10-day reconnaissance tour of the coast, and sure enough, there are huge waves. He actually learned, he never surfed before, he learned to surf just the last 2 weeks in Somalia. And so we started a Surf Somalia ministry, so if anybody wants to surf in Somalia, we now can do that. Anybody? Anybody? I've actually never said this to anybody before because it just happened. So, yeah, okay, zero. So that's so there you go. I mean, maybe you don't surf, and there's not a lot of surfing in Muncie, I guess. I don't know. But isn't it amazing what God can do when you don't give up? And my guess is, just my guess, a crowd of this size, there are some of you who are thinking about giving up. Just a guess. I mean, God didn't, like, tell me this in a dream or anything. I'm just saying, chances are some of you are considering giving up on your marriage, giving up on a friendship, giving up on church, giving up on God, giving up on life even. I guess, just a guess in a crowd this size. And the cool thing is, if you don't do that, if you don't give up, you'll bear fruit. You'll reap a harvest. And I actually think above all of the things in our lives, God gives us this ability to choose. We have the choice of giving up. You can give up. And people do walk out of things, right? People do leave church because they're mad about the carpet. I mean, believe it or not, I'm a pastor's kid. I know people actually leave church. The music is too loud, you know, whatever. I mean, the guy's got a ponytail after all. I'd be out of here if I was you. I mean, right? You know, I mean, Matt's only like, what, 23 years old? I mean, you know, there's lots of reasons. Seriously, if you want to leave, there's lots of reasons. There, you can justify. And if, by the way, if you're married, you might have, you know, the number one reason for divorce is irreconcilable differences. Well, hello, it's called marriage. Of course you have. One's a woman and one's a guy. You're going to have irreconcilable differences. And it's not going to reconcile. They don't ever become the other one. Like my wife, I've been trying to make her like me for 33 years, and she's never going to be like me. It's not working. You know? I mean, it is working. We love each other, but I'm just saying we're not going to be the same person. She'll never be Carl. And what a horrible idea. I don't want to be married to myself, but sometimes I forget that. And I think I wish if she was just thinking like me, but what a terrible idea anyway. Of course, that's the point of marriage. Two different people that come together that love each other differently, but there's always going to be reasons to quit. There's always going to be reasons to not love your neighbor because your neighbor's obnoxious. If you want to give up, you can. And you know what? God still loves you. That's the cool thing about God. You can actually give up. You can walk away from stuff. You can get divorced. You can leave a church. You can stop talking to your neighbor. You can do that, and God will still love you. It's annoying about God. He doesn't even hold you to the standard that he calls you to. He will love you anyway. You actually can't screw up enough to make God stop loving you. That's kind of cool about God, isn't it? Do you know that's true? You can do nothing better to make him love you more. And you can do nothing worse to make him love you less. He loves you crazily all the time, perfectly. But he says, for our sake, don't give up. Because when you give up, it's not good for you. It doesn't hurt God. I don't believe that our sin is hurting God. It hurts us. God doesn't want you to sin. He doesn't want you to screw up. He doesn't want you to do stupid things because he loves you. It's like, you don't want your kid to run out in front of a car, not because, I mean, it's bad for the kid. God loves us. And he doesn't want you to give up. And when you don't give up, when you stick with it, when you keep going, and the best way, maybe the only way to do that, is in community. I don't think you can not give up by yourself. You can only not give up with good friends who love Jesus. And we call that church. So, Father, I pray in your name, Jesus, that you would help us not give up. I love that scripture. I love that. I love that you said to us through Paul that we shouldn't grow weary in doing good. Because at the right time, in your time, if we don't give up, we will reap a harvest. And I pray for all the ones this morning who are considering giving up on something, that together with a group of friends, they would not do that. That with you, Jesus, as our brother, with you, Father, as our daddy, and with you, Holy Spirit, as the one who guides us and empowers us, and with the community of friends, we can keep going. You're awesome, Jesus. We love following you into adventures, and whether it's across the street, a university, down the road, at our work, with our own family, or it's Somalia, it actually doesn't matter. It's such an adventure and such a privilege to be with you and to follow you. You're such a good King, and thank you for loving us and not giving up on us. It's in your name we pray. Amen.